Hello, my name is Justin DeClue, and I'm here today with
Will Sloan.
And you're listening to The Important Cinema Club. And today, we're going to deal with one of the very late masters of horror, Michele Soavi.
Specifically Italian horror, because This is a filmmaker who came along in the late 80s and early 90s, towards the end of a long 20-year golden age of Italian horror cinema. He was somebody who emerged in the dregs of, you know, after the golden age of Mario Bava, after the golden age of Dario Argento, during the, I say with affection, sewer years of Bruno Mattei.
And he was a guy that was essentially, I don't know if I'll say the first, but one of the most present of the movie brats. If you look at all the horror films that were made in Italy in the, you know, late 60s, 70s, 80s, they were often done by people who maybe they loved horror, like Dario Argento was very clear about that. But then you have other people like Umberto Lenzi or even Lucio Fulci, who they were horror filmmakers, but you get the sense that, like, maybe we could have done something else. I mean, Lucio Fulci did do, early on in his career, tons of different stuff, but we don't talk about any of it. We talk about his horror films.
Well, most of those guys did, with the possible exception of Dario Argento, who hit it big very early on as a director of, like, thrillers and horror films. All those guys, like Fulci, Joe D'Amato, were just journeymen who did comedies, westerns, whatever the trend was, and then horror movies. And the horror movies are typically the ones that we remember.
And Soavi is a guy that doesn't really have like a shocking story of how he got into the industry. I read somewhere that he was a little bit wealthy, which allowed him to get into the film industry. But he was a guy who just loved this kind of stuff. That his dream was to be Dario Argento's assistant director. And he said in many interviews that, like, once he reached that dream, he couldn't even, like, fathom being a director himself. And, like, if you look at his filmography, this is what you cut your teeth on. Working, becoming friends with Joe D'Amato, who, if you're not aware of who he is, like, I'm saying it very affectionately, the sewer rung of Italian exploitation cinema.
Yeah, the hackiest of all hacks. I don't think so. I think Joe D'Amato's a great artist in his way. But for most polite society, they would consider Dario Argento, like the lowest you can go. But Michele Soavi, compared to all these guys who came into horror filmmaking kind of by accident or by circumstance and ended up making a mark
by desperation.
Soavi wanted to, and I think what interested us in talking about him on this podcast was he emerged at exactly the wrong moment. He emerged
the worst
at a
moment.
He emerged at a moment when horror films and genre films in Italy, the market had dried up. They weren't being exported internationally the same way they were 15 or 20 years before. And just at this moment where he had created something really new within the context of this industry, it all went away and then he went away. Well, he didn't go away exactly. He just turned into something very different.
And if you look at his career of assistant directing, I would make a case that the ones that he were involved with, maybe they got a little bit more juice, like 2020 Texas Gladiator, the Joe D'Amato film, even Lamberto Bava's A Blade in the Dark, and especially Demons. Like, that's got a little bit of that Soavi feel to it. Now, again, I could just be talking out of my butt, because how do I know how much the assistant directing was done on that picture? But, you know, I can see it with my own eyes. And, like, if you look at even some Argento films that Soavi didn't work on, because he worked on Tenebrae, like, there's just a little bit something more there.
Well, do you want to give him any credit for Terry Gilliam's The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which he was also an assistant director on?
I do. And that's an interesting job, because he took it after directing Stage Fright. And Joe D'Amato, who produced Stage Fright, was like, what are you doing? Why are you being a second unit director? You just did a feature film. And Soavi said, I love Terry Gilliam, the opportunity to work with him. And Gilliam offered him this job after seeing Stage Fright. I can't turn it down. He even went back years later when Gilliam returned to Italy and helped him on The Brothers Grimm. And listen, there's no saving that one. I'm not putting that one at Soavi's feet.
Yeah, funny he gets to be the father of success, but failure is an orphan, as it so often is the case.
I mean, look, once you get into that period, even Soavi's films, like in the post-2000s era, and we're jumping way far ahead, like, they don't get distributed very much, and a lot of them are TV movies, but that's just the industry that he has to work in. But let's go back. You're probably wondering how we got here. And talk about Stage Fright, his directorial debut.
He begins with Stage Fright, which was a film for Joe D'Amato's Film Mirage company. Film Mirage was a company that D'Amato made with an eye towards exporting films to the United States and other foreign territories. He often did a lot of like sexploitation films, as well as some horror films. Eventually, Film Mirage went out of business because Joe D'Amato just made too many movies for the market. He oversaturated it, bankrupted himself, and ended up going back into making hardcore pornography for the rest of his life. But there was Stage Fright, which is considered by Soavi, which Soavi made and is basically considered like the best of this crop of movies.
Yeah, like Soavi in interviews says that D'Amato approached him, said, hey, do you want to direct it? You've done a very good job as my assistant director on films. Soavi said, I don't know if I really want to. And D'Amato basically pressured him into doing it because, you know, let's be honest, D'Amato, any warm body, he's like, oh, that guy can direct. Let's get him out here. Let's do this. And Stage Fright is basically a slasher. I've seen it described as a giallo, but has the exact same structure as a slasher. And what it does is start Soavi's obsession with kind of the unreality of what you're seeing. It's about a theater troupe that are rehearsing a stage play, and a killer in a big bird mask starts just slaughtering them left and right. And if you just watch it, you know, disconnected from any kind of context, it's a really solid slasher. But if you drill down and you consider what Soavi's trying to do with this, like the basis material written by our favorite George Eastman, Anthropophagus himself.
Yeah, that's right. George Eastman, who is in all of the Joe D'Amato movies, for those of you following along at home. And by all of them, I mean like a fraction of them.
He's the guy who eats his own guts on that infamous poster. And like this film starts with kind of a surreal feel of a woman walking down the street. And only as the film plays out and there's a gigantic burst of saxophone music do you realize you're on a stage. And it cuts to like a woman in a Marilyn Monroe dress on the top of the set, like blowing a saxophone, like na, 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 na. It's almost like Soavi is just so happy to be making a horror film, and he's always trying to play what is reality, what is not, and what does it mean to live in this reality.
Could you talk a little bit more about like the Soavi style, what makes him distinctive from other Italian genre filmmakers? Because I watched three movies for this episode: Cemetery Man, The Church, and then much later, one of his later crime films, which pulled the rug out from under me because stylistically it's so different than those horror movies. The sense I got from the horror movies, not being an expert in Soavi, is it has some of Dario Argento's flair for like strong images and gory set pieces, but also with a strong like American influence. There's a big kooky Sam Raimi quality to them, almost in Cemetery Man, almost a Python-esque quality.
Yeah, I would say probably tone-wise, the thing that separates Soavi from the other filmmakers that he adored is that I think he's very funny, that he can undercut like the horror, not in a way that's like, isn't this a joke, but make like genuine laugh out loud moments and lines. And his visual style is probably what attracted me when I was a teenager. And it's just this kind of like wide angle Terry Gilliam-esque, but not to the extremes of Terry Gilliam. Like if you showed a casual passerby on the street an Argento and a Soavi film, I don't think they could really tell the difference, that they're like, oh yeah, they're just both, you know, visually virtuosic. But there's more of a control with Soavi that I could only put to the feet of someone who has studied these masters. Like if you look at Argento, it's almost kind of unhinged. And sometimes he's doing stuff where you go, well, that's not really working because you don't have a greater context of everything that you're doing. While Soavi, I feel, has a hand on all of the elements. And I can understand, like, people may like Argento more that way because it is kind of like the madman in the lab, while Soavi is more, you know, very focused in what he does.
I see the Sam Raimi influence, or I detect the Sam Raimi influence in the kind of slapsticky comic tone of something like Cemetery Man, you know, the mixture of that kind of tone with extreme gore, as well as certain visual flourishes. Like, his horror movies will have scenes of, like, the camera moving a million miles an hour through space, like it does in Evil Dead 2, for instance. But all of that, all of those kind of slapsticky elements mixed with a tone that is a bit Italian in its, like, dreaminess, you know what I mean? It's like light surrealism throughout.
There's an unreality to all of his films where, like, characters are questioning what they're seeing and what is happening, which you get a lot in Lucio Fulci movies, but in those films oftentimes it's like baked in that it's just organic to Lucio Fulci, while Soavi seems to be very consciously wrestling with all these different elements. Like, Stage Fright has a fascinating structure where it's kind of like all build up for 40 minutes, and then when the slasher part happens, all of the characters are aware of it and they're all killed so quickly and so violently that the last 30 minutes play almost with no dialogue, because there's only one survivor and it's him, like, really doing his Hitchcock-ing, including infamously a gigantic key so he could get, like, that big close-up of, like, you gotta get that key, in the same way that Hitchcock would use in his films.
So The Church from 1989 has been marketed as the third entry in the Demons series, Lamberto Bava's Demons 1 and 2.
Well, Mikhail Soavi did work on Demons, and he plays the villain in that film, the guy in the metal mask. So, you know, he's got a link.
While we're talking about his acting credits, I also want to give a shout out to Alien 2 on Earth, which he's in. Have you seen that one, Justin?
Yeah, a long time ago, and I probably tried to scrub it from my memory.
I kind of like Alien 2 on Earth. I don't know. Maybe I'm the only one who likes that movie.
Soavi cameos in almost all of the films that he had anything to do with. Supposedly he did want to be an actor, a James Dean type, if you will. And yeah, he always pops up. Wait, he's a killer in a lot of films. Spoiler alert, an early Lamberto Bava one as well. He also plays the murderer. You get the sense that mostly because, like, he will do anything. Like, in Demons, he plays the guy, like, wearing, like, the makeup and the metal mask and has to do some dangerous stuff at the end. He's like a guy, he's like, I'm just so happy to be here and I will do whatever is necessary.
But getting back to The Church, if you know that it's officially, or maybe unofficially, I don't know, the third entry in the Demon series, that sets up some false expectations for
Absolutely.
It. Demons 1 and 2 are, like, your quintessential, the bar is having a bad movie night and they're projecting, like, a crazy movie on the wall that you can eat wings and drink to.
Those two movies are very easy to follow that, like, you know, there's a bunch of people in a building and then a bunch of demons show up. And, what are we going to do? There's a very, like, one would say a logical progression to how the things go. And when you sit down and watch The Church expecting that, you will be disappointed, because it is almost like Buñuelian in its structure, with each character having their own episodic thing that basically does not affect the rest of the movie.
Well, I realize that I'm, like, constantly comparing Soavi to other filmmakers on this episode, but this feels like a mix of several different directors' styles. There is a little bit of Fulci in this movie, just in terms of its languid pace and dreamy, otherworldly ambiance, but a lot of Argento in kind of the crispness, the sharpness, and harshness of the, like, big kill scenes. You know, the way they're edited, the way they're staged, the way they're framed, almost like as, like, you know, little music videos within this dreamier package.
Argento did work as a producer on this film, and as he did with the other Demons pictures. And Soavi, when he's talked about it, like, he's like, yeah, we may have had a few disagreements, which is why the film is very anticlimactic, where you're like, oh, that's it, eh? All right.
Well, watching it right after Cemetery Man, it felt like, I kind of wish I'd watched it right before, actually, because it felt like a movie that is progressing towards Cemetery Man. It feels like him figuring it out. Just a brief plot synopsis. It begins hundreds of years ago when the Knights Templar are pursuing a witch hunt in a small Italian village. There's a mass grave where many, you know, suspected witches and others involved in the supernatural allegedly are buried. And then centuries pass, this church is built over it. A librarian and a student are seeking to restore the beautiful fresco at the church, and they open up a portal to hell. There's also a young Asia Argento, in fact, a teenage Asia Argento, as a daughter of one of the leaders of the church, who's appears both in that opening scene as well as in the present day.
And when you hear that, you may think, oh, okay, ah, the demons, we're going to have to fortify us in this church. No, that's not what it is. Instead, it's like 10 different people wrote 10 different nightmares that they had and handed it to Suavi and said, all right, you put all these together. And he's like, okay, I'll try my best. So like all the scenes feel very disconnected from each other. It does feel like a dream where like something horrifying will happen that seemingly everyone should react to, but then everybody ignores it and they just go on with whatever they were doing.
A common complaint people have about this movie is that it's glacially paced, but I don't know. It works for me. I think he has a strong command of the tone throughout. I think he mixes the strange, dreamy tone with the extreme gore sequences pretty effectively and convincingly in a way that I don't always think Argento does. And yeah, some of that Buñuelian, or maybe a more apt comparison would be Fulcian, nightmare logic of the movie, I think works very well.
And then we have Cemetery Man, or its original title, De la Morte de l'Amour, which is the film that I bought on VHS at a comic book store as a teenager, watched it and went, what the hell is this? This is amazing! And made me a Suavi fan for life.
And this is the one, it's the pinnacle of his career. In fact, it did receive some like distribution in North America. It was widely seen and reviewed, but despite, you know, its success d'esteem, it didn't really lead to anything. He didn't have another theatrical release for another 20 years after this.
And Cemetery Man has a really good pedigree that it's based on a novel by Ciano Scalvi, who, I'm going to make this as quick as possible, is very famous for creating a character named Dylan Dog, who's like a supernatural detective in Italian comics. And wait, who is Dylan Dog unofficially based on that he looks exactly like him? It's Rupert Everett. And then so when it comes time to make Cemetery Man, which is based on this author's material, their first go-to is Rupert Everett, who's like, yeah, whatever, I'll do it. Dubbing his own voice, a rarity for these kind of Italian pictures. But that also shows where you're getting. Like, this is 1994, where Italy is like, okay, we're going to start doing audio on set, but not everybody. So you're still going to get a dreamlike feel where people are opening their mouths and you're going, well, that's not their own voice. But if you watch English dub, it absolutely is Rupert's.
So unlike The Church, this movie is basically a comedy, although that doesn't mean it's like gag, gag, gag throughout. He does an interesting thing with the tone. I'm saying the word dreamy so often, but I don't know. I don't have another word for it. It's like this movie also has that dreamy off-kilter tone of something like The Church, but torqued just a little bit towards absurdism.
Very Monty Python-esque, like you said.
Yeah. Rupert Everett is like plays it completely straight. He's this very strong pillar in the center of it as this man who works at the cemetery. But then he also has this assistant played in a gargoyle-like performance by François Haji Lazaro, an assistant named Nagy.
I think I would say Chaplin-esque, thank you very much, Will.
He's small, rotund, he's possibly mentally challenged in some way, and he is in love with the severed head of the mayor's deceased daughter.
Well, I forgot one important thing, that Rupert Everett, as the titular cemetery man, works at a cemetery where every 7 days, the dead that are buried there come back to life. Sounds scary, right? No, not really for Rupert Everett. It's just like another annoying task he has to do in a life where there's very little joy there, where he's kind of just going through the motions, which is why you would understand this is a very big movie for depressed teenagers, because it reflects them, especially in that kind of sardonic way that he reacts to every situation.
Yeah, so the tone of the movie is kind of strange because it has this lore of, yeah, every 7 days the corpses come back to life. Not all of the corpses, by the way.
No.
Only some of the corpses come back to life. And you think, because it's set up in the first 2 minutes of the movie, that this is going to become important in some way.
It's not important.
It's not. It's just kind of a background detail. You think that this fact, like this is the setup of the movie. He's working in a cemetery where every 7 days the corpses come back to life. No, it's just, again, it just happens. The actual story of the movie is his doomed or frustrated love of this woman, played by Anna Falchi, who keeps appearing in different guises throughout the course of the movie. She's not necessarily the same woman, much like a Hong Sang-soo movie. Mm-hmm. She just appears, but she may be the same woman in some way. She may spiritually be the same woman. When he first meets her, she's newly widowed. They fall in love quickly. They have sex in the cemetery.
Her husband comes back to life, bites her, seemingly killing her.
But she dies. But then she comes back again later in the film. I don't want to spoil too much, so just skip ahead. But later in the film, when she comes back, for example, she says, "Oh, I love you, but I am afraid of an erect penis. I cannot take manhood, so I can only be in love with an impotent man." So he says, "God damn it." You know, he goes to the doctor to get some medicine for his, you know,
well, his first reaction is to get it cut off with garden shears, basically. He's like, "Just do it."
Yeah. And then he comes back and she says, "Oh, I've changed my mind. Actually, I love erections now. In fact, I'm going to get married to the mayor."
You know? Yeah. So, you know, good old cemetery man himself not having a really good one throughout all this. And watching it again this time, I was trying to like piece together, all right, what is he trying to say here? Like, this character is so depressed in the movie. Like, the classic, like, "Oh, the weather's turned." And then you look up and it's like sunlight. He has like the very sardonic narration throughout it. It's almost like someone who's given up on life. And like, how do you get back to some kind of being alive? I mean, literally the embodiment of death shows up, played by the skeleton that showed up as death in Baron Munchausen, and is like, "Can you even tell the difference between the living and the dead? Like, if you're feeling like this and you don't want to interact with anybody, what is the point of being alive and continuing with life? What do you want from this?"
Yeah, and this is why it's so crucial that the central gimmick of the movie, the central sales point that, yeah, the dead come back to life after 7 days doesn't matter. Because, of course, it wouldn't matter if you're depressed. And it's also like a masterstroke that the movie is basically funny throughout.
Oh, it's like so funny.
It's like, it's funny without exactly being like a ha-ha comedy, because it's just absurd. It's like, it's a particular depressed state of mind where it's like nothing matters and everything's ridiculous, you know?
Because by the end of the movie, it's getting technically serious, as in that, like, oh wow, he is affecting the real world and people are dying, but it's still like one-liner after one-liner after one-liner after one-liner.
And it's good that Rupert Everett is like playing it straight in the middle of it all, like that he's a firm anchor and you do care about him, you know?
Yeah, even though that he is such a, you know, morose individual, like a 12-year-old, there is a kind of sadness that is sympathetic in what he does, that like, because you have him being, you know, jokey in his narration, but then actually seemingly in love with these versions of the women that keep showing up and then losing it, like, you feel for him, that you want him to grab onto something as everything is being pulled away from him. And like all the Sawavi movies, Stage Fright, The Church, even The Sect, it's all about like reality itself is falling away around him. This very, you know, silly, oh, the zombies come back to life thing. They even say one-liners in the English dub. By the end, it's like, oh yeah, but what if everything was going away? That everything you held on to, even these zombies, don't really mean anything. Like, where do you go?
So after this, no more theatrical films for 20 years.
Now, I read somewhere that it's because Sawavi had to take care of a sick child. So that took him out of it for many, many years. But even if he had stayed in the game, I don't know how many theatrical films he was making, because by the late 90s, Italy was not making any theatrical features.
Well, by the turn of the millennium, he had reinvented himself as a television director. Mostly
reinvented himself. Yeah, I guess this is the only thing I can do.
I mean, you know, it's a reinvention of sorts. He's still in the game. And he's directing made-for-TV crime movies. What do they call them in Italy? Politichettis?
Well, that's a term for just kind of general crime movies as well, because you get all the Enzo J. Castellari movies are like that. But, like, his TV shows, I've seen one of them. It's fine. Like, it feels like a TV movie. Like, he'll slap a wide-angle lens on one of the scenes and be like, whoa! It's like, Sawavi's back! No, then we go right back into the, you need to make your day, you need to just get it over with, and that's what it is. He even made, like, a epic miniseries about the life of a saint called Saint Francis, which I also have on DVD. Back in the day where, like, companies like Raro Video were, okay, what is anything related to a famous filmmaker? Can we put it out on DVD and will someone buy it?
But in 2006, he comes back with another theatrical film, a crime movie, completely different in style and tone from those earlier horror films, called Arrivederci Amore Ciao, or as it's known in America, well, it's not known in America, but as it would be known, The Goodbye Kiss. So this one definitely caught me off guard, but you, who have gone like panning for gold in the Michael Soavi Dark Matter, recommended this one, and I did like this movie.
I wasn't panning for gold. I was there during this creation, following along at twitchfilm.net. I even read the English translation of the novel before the movie came out. That's how dedicated I was to my Soavi craft. And I remember reading the novel and going, I don't think I'm going to like this movie.
So did you see it when it was new?
I didn't like it when I saw it. Because I guess maybe I wanted something like Cemetery Man. And so, like, I need to make clear right away that, like, this film is so miserable. This feels like a poison pill that a director that's been doing TV for years is like, all right, I got one more in me. I'm going to put up both my middle fingers and, like, I want the audience to leave the cinema in complete, like, oh boy, I have a real pit in my stomach.
Well, for the first 20 minutes, just looking at the movie, just the visual style, I thought, oh God, this looks terrible. I don't know if it was shot digitally or not. It was probably shot on film at this point, but it looks like it could have been. And so, like, it's dark and dingy and beige and gray. But then as the movie went along, I thought, no, wait, I'm kind of adjusting to this visual style. It's completely different than the earlier movies, but parts of this movie look like it was etched in charcoal. It's just like inky and dark and depressing.
I do think he still got his wide angle style, and like his weird cutting style is all over this picture. But the story that he's telling is about and it's a little bit hard to grasp at first, where they keep showing stuff seemingly out of order and you're like, wait a minute. And it's almost a fascinating like literary device where you're going to see a character who's going to do a lot of bad things throughout the film, who is your protagonist. So if you kind of shuffle it up at the beginning, you trying to grasp what is going on creates an attachment with the character. So when things go sour, you're like, oh, wait, what's going on? So I'm following this guy that he was in South America and he killed his best friend at the end of a revolution. And now he goes back to Italy, where he is tried for crimes that you later learn on is like basically anarchic crimes where blowing up something and an innocent person got in the way. And then he goes to jail for those, but he gets a lowered sentence by ratting out all his friends. So right from the get-go, you're getting a protagonist that killed his best friend and then ratted out all of his like political friends. And you're going to follow him for another 90 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I like movies. I have a soft spot for movies about disillusioned or disappointed ex-political radicals. In this movie, the protagonist, Giorgio, he was a left-wing activist in the 70s who, after a botched terrorist attack, went into hiding amongst the guerrilla fighters of Central America for 15 years. And after 15 years, he was tired, had lost his piss and vinegar, wanted to go home. So yes, to go home, he killed his best friend. He goes over and he cops this plea deal where he rats out all of his friends. And there's somebody who they're going to pin the terrorist attack on, you know, and that'll make him free. But then there's this corrupt cop who says, I have photographic proof of you doing the terrorist attack, so you belong to me now. And the rest of the movie is him becoming quickly acclimated to this lifestyle of crime, doing heists, skimming off the top of the strip club, all of this. And it's like the world's most depressing Wolf of Wall Street.
That's absolutely what it is.
Yeah.
And you only realize it when you look at it, the entirety of it. It's almost a game that Soavi is playing of anytime he gives you a little bit of sympathy for the main character, like, oh, the job that they were on was botched, he'll just like sucker punch you with like, oh, but he's going to do something way worse to continue surviving. Like, is this worthwhile to have him just existing? Which comes to a head at the end of the film, which it's difficult to talk about this without, like, I remember putting down the novel and I was like, the movie can't end like that, right? Where it's basically the character, so you see him do all this, like, you know, you know, terrorist actions, you see him doing crime. That's all really disconnected from what any viewer would understand, that like, this is genre stuff. But then at the end, he does an act that takes so long and that is so mundane in what it's achieving, just so he can keep on going, that is like the final suave, like, oh, here we go, right in the stomach for anybody watching.
And I think what keeps me going throughout the movie, I mean, to call the protagonist unlikable is an understatement, but there is something very human about him and his political and personal evolution. The idea of, yeah, across this 15 years, he just like lost faith in everything he believed in. And where do you go from there after that? All he believed in was his own survival at the end of the day. And there's something that one can empathize with about that.
There's even like a sympathetic flashback that contextualizes the act that got him in all of this, where he tried to save the guy that blew up in the explosion. And like from there, you get on his side for a moment where he does something to get out of the situation that he's in, that you're like, yes, this is what you should have done from the beginning. You know, it may not make logical sense, but it makes emotional sense, only for the script and Suave to then go, okay, but now he's going to do the worst thing. It's such like, you never see, I guess, mainstream North America. You'll see indies do this kind of stuff. But like Suave, this is like the darkest version of Cemetery Man you could make. Almost like a person losing themselves. But instead, Cemetery Man ends with, depending on how you read it, like a little bit of hope and understanding. The goodbye kiss is like, nope, that's it. He will burn everything to the ground just so he can keep going.
I'm glad you said that, because I was struggling to find the link between Cemetery Man and this, but I can see it now.
Man, I wish Suave could have continued to make films, but like it just wasn't there for him. And maybe there's like a great TV movie in his filmography, but like looking at his letterbox, each image like the same as the one before, like, ah yes, this is the political backstory about I keep hoping he'll have another one in him. Actually, I have to say, he did direct a film that I saw many years ago that, boy, it was like catnip for me, about like a witch during Christmas, and I was like rubbing my hands together. It's like, Suave, baby, you're gonna be back. I do not like that movie very much. And it's shot in a way where it's like, oh no, has he lost it? Has TV just kind of like taken it out of him? It has none of that control or just understanding of what he's doing. It's a bummer. And I hope Suave makes another one. But at this point, who knows? For years, they kept talking about like, oh, he's got another one coming up. Like Nick Cage was attached at one point of like a Treasure Island film that Suave was going to direct. So like it was always in the air, but never quite happened, unfortunately.
So Mickey L. Suave, yours to discover.
All of his films, which for a long time were kind of unavailable, other than like really okay looking Anchor Bay DVDs, have recently been put out by Severin in like a bunch of super duper special editions. And Blue Underground put out Stage Fright. So they're all there, all the horror ones. Stage Fright, The Church. We didn't talk about The Sect, which is kind of his version of Rosemary's Baby, which, it's okay. I kind of find it really overcooked. And Cemetery Man, which for the longest time was completely unavailable in North America, now has a big deluxe 4K release. So I'm sure that his group of fans will only grow from there.
Do we have any letters this week, Justin?
We do have letters. As per usual, you can send us letters at importantcinemaclubpodcast@gmail.com. Our first letter is from John Walter, and he goes, longtime listener, first time writer. I was greatly amused by Justin's obvious distaste for the aura of cool that surrounds Jim Jarmusch's in your episode about him. I have to admit that I have some sympathy for that view, at times growing tired of the cultural omnipresence of the Andy Warhol, Lou Reed, Patti Smith, etc. cool bohemian NYC axis evoked by Jarmusch in his films. However, much I might enjoy some of them. All this got me thinking, who are some of the filmmakers, some auteurs who are extremely uncool? Filmmakers who, regardless of the quality or lack therefore of their films, might be somewhat embarrassing to mention as one of your favorites. My first thought was Christopher Nolan, but he seems way too popular to fit in this theoretical category. What do you think? And no, Jerry Lewis doesn't count. Anyway, thanks so much for the great show, Jonathan.
That's an interesting question. Wow.
The Woodman, your favorite. You definitely don't want to say he's...
it's not exactly that Woody Allen isn't cool per se. It's that he's unfashionable for other reasons.
That's right. I mean, the quality of his current movies as well. But
there's that.
You definitely don't want to say, I have enjoyed Woody Allen films in a group setting, because...
I will say that Rifkin's Festival is a pretty uncool movie.
It is the uncoolest movie that you could possibly get. I mean, you get uncool as a filmmaker as you grow older. That's just the reality of what you're, you know, you're doing, especially if you're a filmmaker who's known for a particular thing and then is demanded to do that thing. George Romero and his, you know, late period series of films.
Oh, I have one. I realize that in some circles, like amongst, I don't know, 13-year-olds, he may be very cool, but Tim Burton.
Among
right now.
I mean, he was cool when he came out, but
yeah,
the juice is loose.
Again, maybe if you're in the seventh grade, he's really cool right now. You love Wednesday. You love all that shit. But if you're well, hey, I'm 35. I'm not cool anymore. What do I know?
But like, you could pick any filmmaker that we liked when we were young. Like, oh man, I'm a huge Guy Ritchie fan. You would look very uncool if you said that.
Well, we mentioned Terry Gilliam. I think he's a little uncool now.
Oh, yeah. He's very uncool these days. Yeah. But, man, you said you were a Terry Gilliam fan in the early 2000s. People would be like, yeah, if only he got a chance to direct the movies, he could really direct. You're like, yeah. Not anymore.
Then he did. Then he made Tideland. He made Dr. Parnassus. He made The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. He made The Zero Theorem. There, he's had his chances.
So I think, like, the uncoolest directors are absolutely the ones that were popular at one point, and then just with time, you look back and you go, oh, no, I don't know about that. Or they continue making films, and you're like, oh, no. I mean, isn't the most uncool director that ever lived Whit Stillman?
Well, he is kind of cool, though, just in, like, he's been embraced by some of the cool kids, you know?
Yeah,
Some of those New York people love him.
I mean, those people are not cool, then. It's me as a 36-year-old, I'm saying it.
Yeah. What do I know? I don't know.
Would a cool man love Donald Duck? Wait, it was him,
like,
right?
He's so uncool that he's kind of become cool.
Yeah. You're right.
But what about? I mean, Ron Howard sort of transcends all of this. Like
But he's uncool in a way that, like, he was never cool. What's worse, being considered cool, then you become uncool, or just being lame the entire time? Probably the first one, right?
I would agree. Yeah, it's more embarrassing. The stakes are higher.
I don't care if I'm cool. That makes me cool, right? No, that's really... I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I'm trying to think of other filmmakers that, like, would be known by people. Like, people love Wes Anderson. I guess Wes Anderson's cool, right? He's still fashionable. He's never going to go away.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's so culturally omnipresent in a way, which is a weird thing to say about somebody whose movies make $20 million.
But... And he's so specific in his style, and over time he has not tried to broaden his horizons. If anything, he has just narrowed them, like, with every new film opportunity. Did you try to watch those Roald Dahl adaptations that he did?
I have not watched them, which is crazy, and I think that speaks more to just how, like, if it's on Netflix, it doesn't exist.
They're all, like, basically narrated the stories by an actor. Every single one of the shorts, I was like, I can't do this. This is wild. Like, it's a stylistic choice I just cannot get on board with.
I thought it was so great that Wes Anderson didn't come to collect his Oscar for...
Well, he didn't think he was going to win for, like, best short.
No, he probably did think he was going to win, and he was probably like, that's not real. I made Asteroid City this year, and you fuckers didn't nominate it for anything.
Jordan Hess, director of Napoleon Dynamite, directed an animated short that was nominated. I was like, I wish Jordan Hess could get a Oscar.
That's an uncool director right there.
Oh, man. Jordan Hess and Wes Anderson face-to-face at the Oscars, something you never thought was going to happen.
Oh, is Kevin Costner an uncool director, would you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. 100%. Yeah. Is Kevin Smith uncool?
Yes, absolutely he's uncool.
We are the deciders on this, so...
And can somebody ask us, like, what fashions are cool now? What neighborhoods? What drinks? Just, like, we'll be the arbiters of this.
I mean, when I visited my old hometown and I drove by the school and just glanced over at all the kids that were, like, hanging out, I was shocked. They were dressed exactly like me and my friends were in the early 2000s. Fashion has completely turned back around, and I don't like it. You know, some people would be like, oh, I like, you know, what I like was popular. No, get it out here. I want hover boots and, like, people wearing, like, rings around their arms. Let's move fashion ahead, not snap it back to, like, frosted tips and things like that.
Man, if the kids get frosted tips, I'll be so happy.
Did you ever have frosted tips, Will?
No. But when they were around, I always thought, like, oh, this is... Frosted tips are so cool. Things will never get more cool than this. This is the ultimate in cool.
I never even put gel in my hair.
some of those early 2000s fashions look more dated now than, like, I don't know, the 19th century, whatever they were.
Absolutely. Hey, yeah. But if they're coming back, that means, you know, they still got some cultural weight behind them.
Amen.
So as per usual, you can send us letters at importantcinemaclubpodcast@gmail.com. This week on our Patreon, it's our monthly What We've Been Watching segment. Yay!
Oh, yeah. Also, last week, we talked about Steven Seagal in Half Past Dead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you guys are like, it's been a while since they've talked Steven Seagal, will they still have that joie de vivre when they talk about their favorite lazy Marlon Brando in it, like the low energy performance in a theatrical film? Yes. Yes, we do. Big smiles on our faces the entire time.
Oh, nothing has ever made me happier.
So you can check that out at patreon.com/theimportantcinemaclub.
So next week on the podcast, we're going to be talking about Ilya Suleiman, who is the most famous Palestinian director of all time. Now, this is a director who I actually, until a couple months ago, didn't even know about. But we were doing a Michael and Us episode, and we were looking at lists of Palestinian movies. We wanted to do a Palestinian filmmaker. And, you know, the lists... Every movie was a title like, you know, The Fence or something like that. And we were like, is there something that shows, I don't know, some other side of Palestinian culture? And Ilya Suleiman, who, again, it's on me that I didn't know him because he's been in competition at Cannes. But we watched a film of his called It Must Be Heaven, which I thought was fantastic. I thought it was beautiful. And he has been described as the Buster Keaton of Palestine, if you can imagine that.
Wait a minute. We're getting the Michael and Us sloppy seconds? I'm very excited to talk about this filmmaker.
I just want to explore him some more. So we'll be talking about, I think, The Time That Remains is his best-known movie. There's one called Divine Intervention. There's one called Chronicle of a Disappearance. He's only made 4 feature-length films and a number of shorts. So he's not that hard to tackle. And yeah, I mean, It Must Be Heaven, when I saw it a few months ago, was just a real balm for the soul, I thought. So I'm eager to learn more about him.
So that's what we'll be doing next week. And until then, my name is Justin Clue.
I'm Will Sloan.
Thanks for listening. As per usual, I would like to thank some of our new patrons, who include Jordan, Ian Bennett, Fox Burden, Joshua Barfoot, Patrick Carroll, Tim Schmeidel, Nick Brown, George Johnson, and Nick Cook. Thank you very much for becoming patrons. We could not keep doing this without you.
Well, the juice is loose.
Oh, man, is it ever. Speaking of Tim Burton... So you saw the Beetlejuice 2 trailer?
Yeah. So my social media things are so kind of like clean that like I don't see any new trailers, nothing. There was like a Star Wars trailer that dropped. There was a Beetlejuice trailer. And it's not until my friends in a group chat mention it that I'm like, oh, yeah, that's out, eh?
Oh, it was all that was on my feed. So,
really? Yeah, how did I not see it? I don't think I have like Tim Burton or Beetlejuice like as one of the muted words.
And not only was it all on my feed, but it was just all people saying the same thing about it, which was, I can't believe they did a minor key downbeat, like, Deo. Yeah. That gag from the first movie now getting slavishly brought back in a minor key. Oh, my God.
Now, I'm sure I've said this before. I, as a child, did not have that much of a love for Beetlejuice the movie. I think my parents thought, probably rightfully, when I was like 5 years old, it was too scary, but I loved the TV show. Could not get enough of it. Canadian made. It was a big, wacky world. I vividly remember at one point my mom decided, Justin, we're curtailing like some television because we think it's too adult. No more Simpsons. And the only other one I remember is she said, no Beetlejuice. And that's the one that I was like, no.
That's funny because it's not adult at all, that cartoon show.
That cartoon is not adult. I think it's a weird kind of, I don't know what was going on. Maybe I was a bad Damien-like child at the time, but that was something that was eliminated from my diet. Later on, I would see Beetlejuice probably as a teenager, and I liked it. It's a great movie.
Thing is, you watch some of those recent Tim Burton movies, like Miss Peregrine's Home.
I'd rather not.
Yeah, Dumbo or...
Big Eyes.
Was Dumbo his last one?
Dumbo was his last one.
Yeah, like you watch those and you think, God, did this guy ever have it? And then you go back and watch that first run of movies from Pee-wee to Ed Wood and you realize, yeah,
oh, he had it.
He had it.
You think he made a curse that like, you will make a great Ed Wood film, but you shall become just as bad as people think Ed Wood is. And he's like, I'll take it, whatever you want. Just let me make my Ed Wood picture.
Yeah, and it's very hard to define because, listen, the Beetlejuice 2 trailer was a minute long. Who knows? Maybe the movie is Citizen Kane. Maybe it's the best movie ever.
But just watching that movie, it gives you everything you don't want from a longtime sequel. Hey, look, the cast members are back, dressed exactly as they were in the first movie. Hey, you know the locations you loved in the first movie? They're back too. Why are you doing, I don't want this. No movie has ever been just all the stuff from the first one and worked well. Not even Evil Dead 2. That's a completely different movie from Evil Dead 1.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, this is exactly what it is. I watched modern day Tim Burton movies, and I do watch them when they come out.
I have not seen Dumbo.
Good for you.
I saw some people right when the movie was coming out that they were trying to like craft a narrative that like Dumbo is really Tim Burton speaking at, and they were crushed by everybody else being like, no, bad, terrible, get it out of here.
Yeah, I mean, fuck that shit. It's like Tim Burton, 60 years old and choosing to make a Dumbo remake for Disney. I mean,
what is he doing? Like, he could do anything. Why is he doing Dumbo?
Yeah, I don't know. You see his interviews and he's always like, ooh, well, I identified with the outsider, Dumbo.
Oh, I'm the outsider. Like, oh, wait, who am I married to now? Monica Bellucci? Or who am I dating?
Yeah, this fucking guy, he thinks he's this tortured outsider. He still thinks he's Edward Scissorhands. And it's like, bitch, you made like $1 billion at the box office. You directed Batman. You directed Alice in Wonderland. You're not a fucking outsider anymore. Like,
if anything, you should be on your hands and knees apologizing for like the last 10 years of movies that he's delivered. Yeah. He has been on the circuit going like, there won't be that much CG. We did it all practical. He says he's got the juice again, even though that Michael Keaton's one line in the trailer is like, boy, they're like prodding him with sticks to get him to say that.
Yeah, and I think I would just say, I watch these current Tim Burton movies, and they make me sad because it's like, when is the last time there was an image in one of his movies that surprised you or delighted you? Mm. I would say it's been a very long time. And he used to, in that first run of movies, you would get surprising and delightful images by the truckload. And now
is it
just
because he just doesn't have anything left in his bag of tricks?
I think so. Honestly, I mean, the proof is in the pudding. The fact that this new Beetlejuice just looks like a copy of the first one without the juice, if you'll pardon the pun, I think says everything. It's just like him doing a cover of himself. God.
Can we talk about, though, the movie that everyone made fun of, specifically Kevin Smith's Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, that they're like, why would Beetlejuice want to go Hawaiian? This is absurd. I would love a Beetlejuice Go Hawaiian.
That's
like,
right.
That would be so much fun.
For years, he would only do Beetlejuice 2 if they made it Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian. And you could imagine a younger Tim Burton doing those like Frankie and Annette beach party.
That's
images.
What he said he wanted to do.
Yeah, that would have been funny.
Maybe because that's what he wanted to do for so long that he, you know, something very different than what came before, that when that never got off the ground, he's like, you know what, you fuckers, I'm gonna give you exactly the first movie. You choke it down, I will take another $20 million paycheck or whatever off of the Beetlejuice stuff, and I will sit down and you will smile. Michael Keaton is debasing himself on the screen for you. This is what you want.